Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today, I thought I'd introduce you to a particular guy on a particular day in Manchester, England. It's 1952, and Alan Turing, a math professor, discovers that a number of things have disappeared from his home. It looked kind of like a burglary. He was missing a shirt, a pair of shoes.
An old pair of pants, maybe a compass.
It was stuff. It was just household stuff.
Nothing of any value.
That's Jan Levin and David Levitt. Both of them have written books about Alan Turing.
And so, being very literal-minded, he thought, well, what do you do when you're robbed? You call the police.
So the police come to his house, the detectives, he has this conversation, and they say, you know, he's kind of a curious chap. They let him talk. And they're like, it's a real shame we're going to have to arrest him.
Who?
Turing.
Why would they have to arrest? They're just coming to...
Because he's effectively implicated himself in terms of...
Here's what happened. The police sat Turing down and said, well, who do you think made off with those things of yours? And he says to them...
He suspected the thief was an acquaintance of his boyfriend.
His boyfriend?
Yes, yes.
See, at the time, there was a law in England...
Which criminalized, quote-unquote, acts of gross indecency between adult men in public or private.
So he told the cops that he was having sex with a guy? Was that why
he doesn't exactly say we're having sex, but he says enough that it's clear. Huh. He was never ashamed of being gay. This was just not something, again, that he understood what the fuss was about.
So what happened to him? Was he convicted?
Yeah, he's convicted and he's...
What's his sentence?
Estrogen pills and implants, estrogen implants.
Oh my God.
Yeah, chemical castration.
And when I learned this, I wondered if those policemen had any idea that the guy they were arresting was, first of all, one of the great minds of the 20th century, a war hero who single-handedly, almost by himself, shortened World War II by at least 2 years. Alan Turing then became a myth, but he was also a man. And that's what we're going to do in this hour on Radiolab. We're going to measure men against their myths. And sometimes those men will more than measure up.
Sometimes you might feel they don't.
And sometimes, in one case anyway, they completely disappear. So, today on Radiolab...
Of Men and Myths. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. And to get back to the Alan Turing story, long before he was arrested, when he was just a schoolboy, around 15 or 16 in England,
he gets to Sherborne School, which is the public school, as they say in England.
I guess we would call it a boarding school for boys, where...
What did he look like?
He had dark hair, very dark hair, sort of square face. He wasn't unattractive. He was just so goofy.
So did the other kids make fun of him at school, or did he...
Yeah, I mean, he's teased, taunted, bullied, but he's not completely unhappy. He falls in love...
with another student named... Christopher Morcombe.
Who's very charming, very socially smooth, handsome. They have this bond over science. It's an unrequited love.
Did he express his love to this other kid, or?
He was always sort of there, sitting next to Chris Morcombe. Every class, right behind him, right next to him. And I think at some point Chris commented that, you know, maybe it's a little too much attention. But I don't think he really made a formal declaration of his love. But he did maintain a relationship with Chris's mother. Even after Chris died. Chris Morcombe died while he was still in school of Bavarian tuberculosis. Huh. One day, there was just this announcement, he was dead. So I think it came as a complete shock to Alan.
The only love he had left at that point was mathematics. So he goes off to King's College, Cambridge, to study math.
Yeah, exactly.
He was still kind of a loner.
if you look at photographs of Turing, I think I'm always struck by the fact that he looks like he's not actually there. He looks like he's like a lot of mathematicians. He lives simultaneously in two different worlds. The world that the rest of us live in, and he lived in a kind of extraordinary world of abstraction.
You know, lying in the fields in Cambridge, he would have these epiphanies, these realizations.
And one day, he's lying in Grantchester Meadows, that's near the campus, and he's thinking over a pretty tough problem. Is there a quick, automatic way to prove or disprove a mathematical proposition? And this was a big question in math at the time, the ins and outs of which aren't all that important to us. What's important is that it led to Alan Turing's idea for, of all things, a machine.
The machine doesn't exist. The machine is never built. It is never meant to be built.
This is James Glick, a science writer who has studied Turing.
It's the world's most impractical machine.
But it's very simple.
These were the elements of the machine.
Number one.
Piece of tape. Infinitely long. So therefore, it's already never going to exist because we can't have infinitely long pieces of tape. And
number two, something that reads or writes ones and zeros on the tape. Device. And number three, a set of instructions.
So if you've got a zero, then you go to the left and you write a one. Or if you've got a one, go to the left and you write another one. And you got to remember where you've been, so you have a certain amount of memory. But that's it. And then he proved that the machine could do anything.
You could add, of course, and then you could subtract and multiply. You could also do a little calculus, actually a lot of calculus. You could do trig and mathematical proofs and sophisticated mathematical proofs.
Anything that could be done in mathematics mechanically could be done by his imaginary, idiot, simple machine.
Is this such a big idea? I mean, all you're saying, really, is he figured out how to put logic or actually how to program a machine.
Okay, but no, Robert, you're already cheating. Because as soon as you say you're going to give the machine some logic, and then as soon as you use the word program, you're using very modern bits of knowledge that we've all internalized. But the idea of putting logic into a machine, no one thought of that. That's just weird.
Machines at that time, bear in mind, were generally single function.
The idea that you do your email on your computer and Photoshop, you know, you don't buy a different machine. That is ingenious. That traces back to Turing's original idea that I can build an electromechanical brain and I can teach it how to do different things.
This was the dawn of the computer age.
Computer used to mean a person.
Usually a woman who would sit and do mathematics.
And now we got this guy who's saying that with a simple formula, tape, code, and a set of instructions, we can give human-like abilities to a machine. And not just the abilities of our hands, but the nimble ability of our beautiful brains.
It's a beautiful, magical, simple idea. Turing's machine is Cezanne's watercolors. It's Bach's prelude. He was a lonely 22-year-old just thinking, and he invented a thing that lives in the minds of every computer scientist today. He didn't realize that just a few years later he was going to be applying these same skills to winning the war for England.
The Battle of London, which began with strong forces of Nazi bombers attacking the capital at night, led to a big fire on the waterside.
It's 1940, and the German High Command is sending secret messages written in code to naval commanders, to U-boat captains, saying, "All right, sink that ship, mine this harbor." The messages were encrypted in this crazy-fangled encrypting thing that they called the Enigma machine.
Kind of a typewriter, so
they would type, "Bomb that boat," in German, of course, and the machine would swap the letters and turn the type into gibberish.
But they changed the settings every transmission, and what this meant was that it was considered by both the Germans and the British to be uncrackable.
Except Winston Churchill thought, let me try. So, in total secrecy, British intelligence brought together the most talented amateur decoders that they could find.
They chose mathematicians,
chess champions,
people who could solve the Sunday Times crossword puzzle extremely fast.
And they were all instructed to go to a set of buildings halfway between Oxford and Cambridge. It was a place called Bletchley Park.
But the architect of the effort was really Alan Turing. He thought, well, this code is generated by a machine. Therefore, a machine can be built that will be able to break the code. So he built this machine that was called the bomb. And it was a
and it was huge. It was the size of a wall, and it could try out all kinds of different solutions to this breaking the code problem. And Turing decided to focus this machine on one little Achilles heel that he found in the code itself. At the beginning of a typical message, a German would get on the machine and he'd have
sort of habitual openings.
You know, phrases that were very, very commonly used. And the Germans were fairly unimaginative.
Unimaginative at the start, like, you know, Heil Hitler or good morning or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Heil Hitler or the weather. Or...
So Heil would be H-E-I-L.
Right, yeah.
There's your in.
And then they realized that they could actually crack the code because of this, I would say, mystic.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe.
When the English realized that Alan Turing and his team had broken the code, did that make Alan Turing into a superstar? I mean, did he get birthday greetings from the Queen?
Not at all, because it was all top secret.
Well, does that mean that King George didn't know of Alan Turing, or Winston Churchill didn't know of
Churchill Alan certainly knew.
Churchill definitely took a particular interest in Turing and Turing's transmissions.
Oh, he did?
Sure.
Oh.
No, he's a war hero. There's no question about that. His contribution is of crucial importance in terms of turning the tide of the war in favor of the Allies.
And yet,
as far as I'm aware, Turing was never thanked or acknowledged for what he did.
Well, if I were King George, I would have, like, sent him a little.
He didn't.
Having defeated the Enigma machine, Turing now goes back to his first love, the Turing machine. Mathematicians all over the world are now building computers and big refrigerator-sized contraptions, actually. There was one at Manchester University where Turing took a teaching job. And the one there did a lot more than just math.
And the machine could do all sorts of things. I believe it could sing. I'm pretty sure it could sing God Save the King.
Really?
Not very well.
This is what it actually sounded like. It's not something you really want to march to.
It was not the machine that Turing ideally would have liked to build.
Turing had a bigger idea at this point.
The idea of the thinking machine. He really invented the field of artificial intelligence and was the first person to hypothesize about whether a machine could actually be said to think.
And not just think, thought Turing, but maybe flirt with you a little bit or joke with you. To have a sentience inside an electronic manufactured mind.
And when people said, how would you know that mind was truly sentient? He said, just ask it.
Turing did come up with a test. It's a way to test whether a machine is doing something like thinking, like human thinking.
What we now call the Turing test.
We've described it on our show before.
How we'll know.
And this is from the show we called the Talking to Machines.
Get a person, sit him down at a computer, have him start a conversation in text.
You know, hi, how are you? Enter. Good pops up on the screen.
Sort of like internet chat.
Yep.
So after that first conversation, have him do it again and then again, you know, hi, hello, how are you, et cetera.
Back and forth.
But here's the catch.
Half of these conversations will be with real people. Half will be with these computer programs that are basically impersonating people.
If you can put this thing behind a curtain and you talk to it and it convinces you that it's intelligent and alive and sentient, then it is. What's the big fuss?
But there was a big fuss.
Hold on one second.
A neuroscientist at the time, Sir Geoffrey Jefferson, turned to Turing and said, how dare you? No machine will ever think like a human because no machine can feel like we do and in all the ways we do.
Pleasure at its success, grief when its valves fuse, be warmed by flattery, be made miserable by its mistakes, be charmed by sex, be angry or miserable when it cannot get what it wants.
Huh.
And Turing's response to that was, well, I can say the same thing to you. You know, I can say to you, Robert, I don't know what's going on inside your brain. You tell me what you're feeling and what you're experiencing, but how do I know that how do any of us know that any other human being is a human being?
Turing is really one of the first to say, he's the first to say, it's not just that I want to build a machine that can think, it's that we are machines that think.
We are nothing more than flesh, blood, neurons. We are just machines ourselves.
Just soulless biological machines. And this isn't a dark moment for him.
It's a moment of acceptance, says Jana, but this time it's not about math or science. It's about something bigger. It's about the nature of the universe and our place in it. And according to David, not only did Turing feel like he himself was kind of a machine, he felt a kinship with all the thinking machines that would ever be manufactured in the future, all those mechanical minds. He felt he had something in common with them.
For Turing, the machines were more likely to be victims. Victims of prejudice, victims of injustice, victims of people like Jefferson. Jefferson is saying to the machines, you don't think because I say you don't think. And, you know, England was saying to Turing, you can't be what you are, and we're going to change you.
Which brings us back to where we started this show. It is now 1952. Alan Turing has been convicted of gross indecency, a crime punishable by, as we told you, a jail term, or the court can order you to take hormone injections.
And he was given a choice. He could go to prison, or he could be, quote-unquote, cured. And the cure consisted of massive doses of estrogen.
Nobody of importance went and said to the judge, here's a character reference. By the way, this guy won the world war that we just fought.
Well, I suppose you could say that they were cutting him a break by not sending him to prison, by giving him this horrific, horrific alternative.
What were the hormones supposed to do?
It was the crudest kind of pseudoscience. There was some claptrap theory that homosexuality could be cured through injections of estrogen. What it really did was it made him
impotent and profoundly depressed. He grows breasts. It certainly doesn't work to repress his homosexuality. He's still vocally gay.
But he's also worried that because he's now famously gay, his court case being in the papers and all, that everybody from now on will dismiss his ideas. Writing once to a friend, he said,
I'm rather afraid that the following syllogism may be used by some in the future. Turing believes machines think. Turing lies with men. Therefore, machines do not think. It is signed, Yours in Distress, Alan.
The hormone treatments ended. He kept working, but his mood darkened.
Turing's favorite film was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and he particularly loved the scene where the witch dips the apple in the brew, and she chants, dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through.
One night in 1954, it was June 8th, he was at home, and at some point during that night,
he kills himself.
How?
He laces an apple with cyanide. And he bites from the poison apple.
He left no note. 55 years later, in 2009, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Gordon Brown, issued a formal apology to Alan Turing. And in 2011, coming up on his 100th birthday, more than 34,000 people signed a petition to the British government asking that Alan Turing be given a posthumous pardon for the so-called crime of moral turpitude. In 2012, a government minister, Lord Tom McNally, said, no, that we will not do. Here's the statement. A posthumous pardon was not considered appropriate as Alan Turing was properly convicted of what was at the time a criminal offense. He would have known that his offense was against the law and that he would be prosecuted. And then, in 2013, the Queen herself issued a formal pardon, a power she rarely uses, called the Royal Prerogative of Mercy. It was announced by the British Justice Secretary Chris Grayling on Christmas Eve in 2013, who said that Mr. Turing's sentence would today be considered unjust and discriminatory. It's an amazing life, and I'm in awe that anybody could have accomplished quite as much as he did and suffered as much as he did. It's almost overwhelming. But when I think about it, there's a piece of what Alan Turing thought up that just hurts a little, at least me, this idea that machines can one day become, in effect, our equivalent.
This is still such a powerful and emotional question for us to deal with. And I guess we're still divided between people who think that would be kind of a cool thing and people who think that would be a horrible thing, partly because it makes us feel kind of bad about ourselves. There's nothing magical about us if we're just machines.
Do you fall on one side of these lines?
What I'm willing to say is I think we're just machines. I think we're just made of matter. I'm sorry to be giving religious opinions here, because these are religious opinions. But for me, that doesn't make me feel that we're any less special. That makes, I think, how what a wonderful thing that a collection of matter created by a process of evolution that lasted billions of years, how wonderful that this process and that these little collections of matter are able to produce Cézanne's watercolors and Bach's preludes.
But
I can live with that.
Could you, if I built you a computer that could create equally beautiful watercolors and equally beautiful musical compositions, would you feel happier or diminished?
I think in a way you're asking, if you see how the trick is done, does it then vanish? Does it just become a trick? I feel the art I love is always art that I don't fully understand. There's some mystery there, always. I don't quite fathom it. Now, so when the machine produces music that is as lovely as the music that you and I love, I believe it will still be unfathomable.
James Glick is the author of The Information. It's a book about information theory and artificial intelligence. David Levitt has a book called The Man Who Knew Too Much. It's a biography of Alan Turing. And Jana Levin has a novel about Turing and Kurt Gödel, another mathematician. She calls her novel, and it's quite something, too, actually. It's got a lot of... Well, anyway, it's called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines.
And we'll be right back.
Hey, Radio Lab. This is Billy Davenport.
And Myla Davenport.
We're listeners from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Radio Lab is supported in part by
the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Thank you, Radio Lab.
End of message.
Radio Lab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Hey, Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
This is Radiolab, and today?
Well, today we're doing a show called Of Men and Myths.
Yeah.
And we continue with a tale. It's actually about a person that we think we deeply admire. If, by the way, you have even paused long enough to admire him at all.
Yeah.
And the story comes from our own Pat Walters.
This one is kind of weird. I'm going to start with just talking about myself.
Okay.
I think this is the closest I've ever come to dying.
Really?
It happened when I was 11. So I was in sixth grade. I was at lunch in the cafeteria, lots of kids milling about. And I was sitting at the table with my best friend, eating my little packed lunch that my mom had made for me. And I was eating an apple. And all of a sudden, I couldn't breathe.
And you were choking?
Yeah. And I put my hand up in the air, but then, none of the cafeteria ladies came over, and I put both my hands in the air, and they finally came over and dragged me across the hall to the nurse's office, and...
You're choking all the way to the
nurse? All the way to the nurse's office, yeah.
Gasping for air kind of choking?
No, just totally clogged up.
Clogged up.
And I get over there, and someone calls the paramedics.
Wait, how much time has passed since you breathed?
Like two and a half minutes, I think.
That long?
Yeah.
Wow.
But then the nurse grabs me, wraps her arms around me, jerks me really hard under the ribcage, and this apple peel shoots right across the room.
Nice.
Like a projectile kind of kind of thing?
Yeah, it was like a cartoon. I mean, I don't actually remember. I have a terrible memory, but I pieced this together from, you know, talking to my mom. And the story is just this thing that's been around. You know, I've told it a million times. It comes up at family gatherings. And I don't know, maybe a year ago, I was reading some things online about the Heimlich maneuver. I don't even know how I ended up there. And I realized I didn't know who actually is Heimlich. I didn't know anything about him. Like, who is this guy who invented this maneuver that saved my life? And that's when I discovered a story I totally did not expect.
Hello, it's Patrick.
You downstairs?
I am.
Who's that?
That's Dr. Heimlich.
What?
I'll buzz you in and take the elevator to 4 and turn left.
He's alive?
Yeah.
I just would have assumed he died like 100 years ago.
Yeah, so he lives in Cincinnati and I went to see him because...
You went to see... Does that happen to you every time? You like, if I told you...
Well, this is what's cool about our job, right?
I guess. Yeah. Oh, I've heard of him. I guess I'll go meet him.
I kind of wanted to say thanks.
Hello.
Quite a trip.
Good to meet you.
And I wanted to find out, you know, the story of how he came up with this thing. Can you just say who you are so we have it on tape?
Dr. Henry Heimlich of the Heimlich Maneuver.
Okay. And many other things that we'll talk about.
And each of them is saving many, many lives.
That's a matter of some debate. But let's just start the story at the beginning. And for our purposes, the story starts in the summer of 1941.
Yes.
Heimlich was 21 years old. He was on a train heading back to New York City from a summer camp that he worked at upstate. And as the train is going along the shore of this lake, the front end of it jumped the tracks.
The whole engine jumped into the middle of the lake. I jumped off and walked up the front to see if anyone was hurt.
And as he approached the front of the train, which was sort of sticking in the water, he saw this guy trapped
under the water with his feet under the train wheel.
Like his feet were stuck and he was kind of hanging down into the water?
Correct.
The guy's head was bobbing up and down. He was desperately trying to keep it above the water.
So I jumped in the water and I held him up.
Kind of hooked his arms under the guy's armpits and lifted his head and shoulders.
Out of the water. And I held him for a long time.
For an hour or so.
And
by the time the paramedics arrived and freed the man, a crowd had formed.
Yeah.
And as Heimlich crawled out of the water...
Yeah, a couple of them yelled, you saved a life. You saved a life.
That was the first time. After college, Heimlich went to medical school and became a...
Thoracic surgeon, a chest surgeon.
Started saving lives for a living. Then he joined the military.
I was in the Navy.
Navy surgeon.
Because I like ships in the sea.
Where he saved more lives. And while he was overseas, he noticed that many times soldiers who got shot died not necessarily because they bled out, but because the bleeding from the wound would fill their chest and crush their lungs.
I'm thinking...
There must be a way to solve this.
And one day...
It hit him.
Why not a valve? So I ran to the 5 and 10 cent store.
Bought a few simple parts and actually made this tube device that you could slip into a wound that
takes the air out and blood and lets nothing in.
It's called the Heimlich chest drain valve.
This is a tube and this is the flutter valve.
He showed me one of them. It's just a small 6-inch tube with a little plastic flap that only lets air go one way. Really simple. But during Vietnam, the U.S. Army bought 20,000 of these valves, distributed them to infantrymen.
When your buddy got shot in the chest, you slipped the tube into the chest, and it saved his life.
And they're still around today. I called the company that makes them, and they told me that 4 million have sold since the 1970s. Which translates to, like, who knows how many lives saved.
Wow, so this dude's amazing.
Wait, we haven't even gotten to the good part yet. One morning in the winter of 1972.
Set the scene for me. So you were, at that time, you were living here?
Yes, I was living here.
Heimlich is drinking his coffee, reading the paper, and he happens upon this one article about people who die in restaurants.
In those days, many people who died in restaurants, they were thought to be having heart attacks. Mm-hmm. Until an autopsy was done.
And the article quoted a coroner who'd done a bunch of these autopsies and had found that, actually, no, these people had choked.
The article went on to explain that more than 2,500 people...
Thousands of people were dying...
Every year, from choking.
Yes, I think it was the sixth leading cause of accidental death.
Higher on the list than guns.
And the worst thing was that the great majority were in children.
And nobody knew what to do about it. You could, like, thump a person on the back, but some doctors warned
that if you hit them on the back, the choking object would go deeper into the airway.
Do you remember if there were people trying to come up with, like, devices? I feel like I read something about...
Yes. There was one who had a, like...
Like a pair of plastic pliers.
You would jam that in.
Claw down my throat?
Apparently.
Another guy invented a sort of vacuum that you'd use to suck the food out. Not surprisingly, these things
just weren't effective.
People were getting desperate. I found this little clip from the New York Times, which described this guy whose wife choked on a piece of food in a restaurant. And not knowing what else to do, this guy, who happened to be a surgeon, grabbed a steak knife off the table and tried to perform an emergency tracheotomy.
On her neck? Like on her?
Yeah.
Oh. And what happened?
She died in the restaurant.
Oh. Wow.
So Heimlich was reading about all this, and being a thoracic surgeon...
A chest surgeon.
He had an idea.
I realized that there was enough air in the lungs if you could compress that air...
Push it up against whatever was clogging the windpipe...
You could carry the object out of the mouth.
So, he gets a dog.
He got a dog?
Yes.
Where'd you get it?
Oh, we had a laboratory that had some dogs there.
So this wasn't like Fido, the Heimlich family pet?
No.
Laid the dog down on the operating table, and then he jams this piece of meat...
Probably beef.
...down the dog's throat.
Did he at least sedate the dog before this?
Dog is anesthetized. And he ties a piece of string around the beef in case he needs to pull it out.
Okay.
But anyway, the clock is ticking. He gets behind the dog...
Took my fist just above the belly button and pressed it there. Nothing.
So he tried again.
Repeated it. Nothing.
And then, on the third try, that beef ball
flew right across the room. I knew we had it.
So, in 1974, Heimlich wrote up a little description of his maneuver and sent it to a medical journal. Pretty soon, that got picked up by a national paper.
The Chicago Daily News. And not quite a week later,
a retiree named Isaac Piha, who had just read about the Heimlich maneuver in the paper,
came out on his porch and his neighbor started screaming for help.
Guy runs over to his neighbor's house, finds his neighbor's wife
with her face down in the food. And
just like he'd read in the newspaper,
he did the method and a big piece of meat flew out of her mouth and she fully recovered. And so he was recorded as the first one to use the procedure.
Pretty soon,
stories from around the country
began pouring into Heimlich's mailbox. Los Angeles, California,
Fresno, California.
And it got out very quickly.
It's one about a babysitter saving the kid she was looking after.
To the whole country.
Bangor, Maine. Clearwater, Florida. Here's one about a custodian who saved an eighth grader choking on a ravioli.
You know, they just kept coming in.
There were stories about celebrities being saved by the Heimlich maneuver.
Different actors and actresses.
Cher, Goldie Hawn, Walter Matthau, Carrie Fisher, and Ronald Reagan.
Okay, I am in. This is the symbol that you're choking, right?
Right.
This is Heimlich teaching Johnny Carson how to do the maneuver.
I'm going to put my arms around your waist.
Oh, yes.
Come on over here, and I guess you're going to demonstrate.
He taught Letterman, too.
How to do it.
I just want to read you, Dr. Heimlich, one letter that you got from a third grader in Kentucky.
This is him on Geraldo.
Dear Dr. Heimlich, roses are red, violets are blue. I might be dead if it wasn't for you. A third grader saved from choking on an apple. And if you think you should put...
And for most of us, I think, like, that's where the story seemed to end, with Heimlich as sort of a national hero. But the story goes on and gets kind of murkier.
What do you mean?
Like, at the height of his fame, Heimlich starts going to medical conferences and claiming that the Heimlich maneuver can be used for more than just choking.
Now we have a new use for the Heimlich maneuver, and that's its use to stop an asthma attack.
Asthma?
How? Because...
The way he explained it is that when you have an asthma attack, your lungs get filled with a lot of excess mucus, and that if you do the Heimlich maneuver, it will expel the mucus and stop the asthma attack.
In addition, you can prevent an asthma attack by using the maneuver to keep the mucus out of the lungs. You use it maybe once every week or two.
I live with someone who suffers from bad asthma. I'm supposed to give her the Heimlich maneuver once a week to help her with her asthma? That just seems weird.
Yeah.
Well, does that work?
No, there's no proof that that works.
Huh.
And at the time, asthma experts attacked him, saying the idea was dangerous. And it wasn't just asthma. On TV, Heimlich began to argue
that you can also save drowning victims with the Heimlich maneuver.
Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation is not effective when the lungs are flooded with water. The way to save a drowning victim is to do the Heimlich maneuver first. The lungs will clear after four Heimlich maneuvers.
The Heimlich maneuver expels the water from the lungs.
Does it work?
No.
There are a lot of misconceptions about it when someone drowns, that their lungs will be full of water.
This is Jonathan Epstein.
I'm the executive director of Northeast Emergency Medical Services.
Also a member of the American Red Cross's Scientific Advisory Board. And he says what actually happens in most drowning cases, I didn't know this at all, is that
the back of the throat will kind of spasm or close off
and keep water from getting into the lungs.
And it is so important to quickly start that CPR process to replace the oxygen that was lost.
By giving the Heimlich maneuver, you're not only wasting time that you could be using to put oxygen back into the victim, but you also put them at risk of, like, a vomiting. You do the Heimlich maneuver, they might throw up and inhale their vomit, which could make things even worse.
But did people take this idea seriously?
Yeah. Several major companies that train lifeguards started teaching their students to use the Heimlich maneuver before doing CPR. And for years, thousands of lifeguards were taught to do the Heimlich maneuver first. And as the years went on, Heimlich's ideas got increasingly radical. In the early 1980s, he announced that he might have found a cure for Lyme disease, cancer, and...
I believe that I have a possible cure of AIDS.
AIDS? How do people usually react when you say you have a cure to AIDS?
I don't say it to the wrong people.
Because the secret to his cure?
Malaria.
Kills more than 1 million people every year.
Malaria therapy.
This isn't Heimlich's idea originally. He got it from a guy named...
Wagner Jauregg of Austria.
Who, in the early 20th century...
1918.
...started treating victims of neurosyphilis by giving them malaria.
And, he cured it.
Because the fever was so severe that the fever from the malaria would kill the neurosyphilis, but not the person.
Correct.
And based on this work, Jauregg, the guy who came up with this...
In 1927, he won a Nobel Prize for it.
It wasn't long, though, before antibiotics came along and malaria therapy disappeared. But in the early 1980s, Heimlich figured maybe this could work for seemingly intractable diseases like cancer and AIDS. First thing he tried it out on was...
Lyme disease.
He raised some money.
Got some volunteers. went to the University of Mexico in Mexico City.
And he ran this small, unregulated clinical trial in which he infected these volunteers with South American malaria. The CDC caught wind of what he was doing, denounced the treatment, called it unsafe, but that did not stop Heimlich. And through the 90s and into the early 2000s, he ran other unregulated trials on cancer and AIDS patients.
In South China.
And in Africa.
Ethiopia.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health says Dr. Heimlich's theory about malaria therapy has been thoroughly debunked by medical science.
This is from a report on ABC News that quoted one of the world's leading AIDS researchers saying there's no scientific reason to believe malaria therapy would be effective against AIDS.
And it does have the fundamental potential of actually killing you. That is a big risk to put a person through in an experiment in which there's no fundamental basis to even imagine that it would work.
What happened with Peter? And the criticism wasn't just coming from medical experts.
I have absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea.
This is Heimlich's eldest son, Phil. And he explained to me that several years ago, his little brother, Peter, came out and began publicly condemning his dad's ideas. He launched a website and started sending emails to reporters, leading eventually to dozens of articles, most of which were critical of his father.
Why does a son do that? I have no idea.
When I called Peter, he told me that he didn't do it for any personal reasons, but because he felt his dad's ideas were dangerous, that they were putting people's lives at risk.
And you told me, repeat for me what...
Phil didn't want his father to have to deal with questions about Peter.
Basically, because of the pain that this has caused my parents... Because
in fact, he wouldn't even give us access to his father unless we agreed to that.
I just don't want my parents to go through that.
Phil also had another condition, that we not include Peter's voice. We thought he'd waived that condition in a subsequent interview, and therefore we did include Peter's voice in the original version of this story. But Phil didn't see it that way. Even though some ambiguity remains, we've decided to resolve the matter by respecting Phil's understanding of our agreement for accessing his dad and removing Peter's voice from the story. We should say, though, that even though we removed Peter's voice, this version of the story contains the same facts as the original. Anyway, the whole family drama aside, Heimlich was happy to address his other critics. He said the way he sees it...
Creative ideas are often attacked because people oppose change or do not understand new concepts.
This is from an article Heimlich wrote about his career for the Encyclopedia Britannica.
When a prominent discovery is revealed, particularly if it provides an obvious and simple answer to an important question, experts who have worked for years unsuccessfully on the same problem may lash out at the creator and the idea, because they themselves do not find the solution. Creativity requires courage.
People who have genius and great ideas often have to struggle to get their ideas out.
That's Phil again, and he disagrees with his brother Peter when it comes to his dad's work.
Yeah.
In fact, they don't even really talk anymore.
I trust my father's judgment. I trust the way his mind works, and I trust his ability to find simple solutions to very difficult problems.
And everybody seems to agree that his most famous solution, the Heimlich maneuver itself, is an incredibly effective one. But lately, some people have started to question whether it's the best one. In the end of my conversation with John Epstein,
in the American Red Cross,
the Red Cross guy that we talked to before, he told me that every 5 years, all the major life-saving organizations worldwide get together and review their guidelines for all different kinds of rescues.
It is an exhaustive scientific research process.
They look over
case reports and case studies,
controlled experiments on animals and cadavers. And Epstein told me that two reviews ago,
in 2005,
the report yielded some new information about choking.
It was very clear that back slaps or back blows,
just thumping somebody on the back between their shoulder blades,
appear to be equally effective
as the Heimlich maneuver.
Really?
And in fact, the Red Cross, upon finding this out, went so far as to change their recommendation for what you should do when you find someone choking from just do the Heimlich maneuver to first hit someone on the back 5 times, then do the Heimlich maneuver.
Yes.
Nonsense. It's unbelievable.
And also, the Red Cross no longer calls it the Heimlich maneuver.
Whoa.
What do they call it?
Abdominal thrusts.
Abdominal thrusts?
This is wrong.
And as I sat there with Heimlich, I did start to wonder, like,
how will we remember this guy? Will we remember this guy? I mean, do those bad things that he did later in his career in any way put his legacy as a lifesaver in jeopardy?
When I told people I was coming here, a lot of people reacted with wonderment that you're still here. People thought you'd been dead for 100 years.
That makes me feel very good.
Makes you feel good?
Yes. My name is something that they just know. They just know it so well that it is so fixed established that these handful of people who are trying to do harm really don't mean anything. I mean, to me right now, it's a great pleasure to know my name means saving lives. Mm. And when I'm gone, it's still going to be the Heimlich maneuver, and it's still going to be saving lives. I could just pull up my Google alert with the name Heimlich on it.
Yeah, could you?
Heimlich has a Google alert that he checks pretty much every day.
Here, Sycamore boy saves life of friend choking on atomic fireball. Custodian recognized for saving choking girl.
You find dozens, hundreds of these stories of people being saved by the Heimlich maneuver.
Off duty, police officer saves neighbor's life.
You don't find a lot of stories about the controversy surrounding drowning and malaria therapy, or the Red Cross's new guidelines.
Oregon football player performs Heimlich on man at beef ball.
This is just from 1 week?
Yeah.
And flipping through these stories, it does give you the sense that this guy and his maneuver have somehow become kind of immortal. Which, on the one hand, I kind of get.
Hello.
Hello, is this Mrs. Ennis?
Yep.
This is Pat Walters. I don't know if you remember me, but just before I finished making the story, I found Mrs. Ennis, the nurse who gave me the Heimlich maneuver when I was 11.
That was lunchtime, wasn't it?
It was lunchtime.
Yeah. An apple?
It was an apple. Yeah.
Yes.
And after she gave me the Heimlich maneuver, I sent her a thank you note. And she sent me back this letter.
All right. Tell me when to start.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Right now. Dear Patrick, when I accepted a job as a school nurse in the Wilson School District 33 years ago, I told myself that I would never allow anything to happen to children in my care. To my sorrow, I have watched Whitfield children I loved die of cystic fibrosis, AIDS, accidents, and cancer. I think when you said, "I can breathe," was one of the happiest moments of my life. I treasure yours and your parents' letter and the privilege of being your school nurse. Sincerely and with a big hug, Cindy Ennis, RN.
I get a little choked up just listening to you read that to me.
I feel it very sincerely, Patrick. I truly do. It was from the heart.
I think what I take away from this is that, like, I'll always think of that thing I call the Heimlich maneuver as the Heimlich maneuver. And so will Mrs. Ennis. But when I think about my kids, I don't have any kids, but like the kids I might have someday, when they learn this thing, it won't be called the Heimlich maneuver. And based on what I know now, I really don't think that I would tell them to call it that.
Even though it saved your life.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Pat.
And we'll be right back.
Hey, this is Holly calling from Melbourne, Australia. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now, you're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café, s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Today we're talking about some legends and the men behind those legends. And for this next story...
Hi, how you doing?
We met a guy...
I'm Johnny Hughes. I'm a documentary maker from Britain, also a science journalist.
He's an author. He recently wrote a book...
called On the Origin of Teepees, and it's about...
Teepees, why?
Well, if I'm being honest, it was because it was a sort of pun... On the origin of species. Nothing much rhymes with species. But
you see, Johnny wanted to write a book about the origins of ideas the same way that Darwin wrote his book about the origin of species.
So I went chasing off after teepees.
Which brought him to the USA, and then he ended up driving across the country.
Straight across. Going west onto the Great Plains.
As he did, the farms gave way to prairie and then to wide open fields. And it was at that point that he noticed something a little different. There was a distinct change in headgear.
Yeah, as soon as you get onto the short grass prairie.
Right after Bismarck.
There's a very obvious transition from baseball caps to cowboy hats.
And that got him to wondering, like, how did the cowboy hat get to the West? And he's decided to do some research.
So the answer one to the question, who invented the cowboy hat, it's straightforward.
And it goes like this. 1865, the gold rush. Colorado, everyone's coming in from all over the world to make their fortune paying for gold. They bring their hats.
So there's a sort of mixture of hats from all different parts of the world, from the north, from the south, from the cities. Quite a ridiculous collection of hats, we might say. You've got silk top hats.
No.
Seriously.
In color, in the gold rush?
In the gold rush.
That would be your Abe Lincoln hat.
Great in the East Coast cities. Pretty useless on the top of Pike's Peak.
Why? Because it gets blown off by the wind?
Blown off, it gets wet.
So you've got your Abe, but you also have...
Raccoon skin hats, the sort of Davy Crockett things.
Great in the winter, but come the summer...
They got full of fleas, and they made you really hot as well.
That's not good.
You also had straw hats from the plantations from the south.
Which are, I don't know, kind of flimsy.
There would have been some sombreros.
Not bad, actually.
Yeah, keep the sun off your eyes, keep you cool. But they have enormous brims. The
problem is, when it rains...
Water just collects and stays on there.
There you are in Colorado with lots and lots of hats.
But none of them were perfect. All of them were slightly unfit.
Enter Mr. John B. Stetson.
He was the son of a hat maker in the East Coast. And he came over looking for his fortune. And the story goes.
When he landed in Colorado, he looked around and he immediately saw an opportunity.
Went back to the East Coast, gathered his thoughts.
And in a moment of unnatural and inspired inspiration, if you can be so inspired, he saw...
The fully formed cowboy hat.
In his head.
Yeah. So he had the model in his head.
And what was it?
So his model was, it needed to have a wide brim to keep the sun and the rain off your head. But not as wide as a sombrero, because that was impractical. But also much wider than, a top hat, which was useless.
And it needed to be waterproof?
Because he knew that it was wet over in the west.
Needed to have a high dome on top to keep you cool up there?
He knew what it ought to be.
So after a little hammering and stretching and cutting, he had the perfect hat. And he called it...
The Boss of the Plains. which everyone in the West wanted to be. So, picture the scene, boss of the planes arrives, it's gorgeous, you want one. You threw away your horrible raccoon thing, and you went for one of those. It very quickly became a status symbol.
That is story number one.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
It was a guy.
It's a guy.
It's J.B. Stetson. He came up with the idea. He was a genius. He got it sold.
Okay. What's the problem with that story?
Well, the problem with that, says Johnny, and he realized at the moment he landed out West and he started to look into this.
Uh-huh.
Close your eyes and imagine, you know, your quintessential cowboy hat.
You asking me to do this?
Yeah, please just do it.
Okay. Got it in my head.
Is it a high dome?
Yep.
Broad brim?
Very. It's got a dent in the top.
Well, see.
The picture that we have in our heads is not what Stetson invented.
Really? Why? I mean, what did Stetson's look like?
Probably the dullest cowboy hat you could possibly imagine. No rolling at the edge of the brim, no dents on the crown. It had a little ribbon around it.
A ribbon?
Yeah.
It's not very bossy. That's dainty.
So Johnny did some more research, and he now comes up. This is coming up now. Theory number two to explain who or what designed the hat. Again, 1865. It's Colorado Gold Rush time. People are coming in from all over. J.B. Stetson shows up. He makes the hat. But the hat was very expensive.
You couldn't afford more than one. So from then on, for the next 10 years...
You would wear it, like, all the time.
You'd be picking it up the whole time with the crown, so you'd be pushing these dents into it every time you sort of yee-hawed. And you'd also be sleeping on your hat, so you'd be folding over the brim. So within a few years, the cowboy heroes, these guys are turning up at the railhead towns with these, what we might call in Britain, knackered boss of the plains hats.
That looked like a completely different hat than the one they'd bought in the store.
Yeah. They'll be battered.
And, you know, think about this. If you're a young cowboy and you're looking for your first cowboy hat...
Do you want one that looks like the guy who runs the hardware shop?
Who's got the pretty dainty one.
Or do you want the one with the dent in it, like your dad, the cowboy?
And so hat makers picked up on this and they began producing pre-dented, crumpled, knackered hats.
Stetson responded as well. You can look through the kind of order books of Stetson, and you will see the designs change over time.
All of which is to say, if you want to tell the story this way, you can say, yeah, Stetson was there, Stetson played his part, but when it comes to a true cowboy hat, the one we think of when we think of a hat, Stetson really didn't invent it.
The cowboys did. The entire population of cowboys were instrumental in choosing the future evolution of the cowboy hat. It's almost like the market's deciding, which in this case is cowboys.
And can I just plant my flag and say that seems like a very sensible theory?
It does.
But
something about this story number two was still nagging Johnny.
Oh, there's more.
He's going to go one more round. Do you want to come with him?
I will go.
Here we go.
The third answer to the question, who invented the cowboy hat, is no one did.
Well, someone did.
What I mean is that there were no mindful decisions going on here. Not even a community of people mindfully chose where the cowboy hat was going to go.
Mindfully?
Yeah. So,
what do you suppose he means by mindfully?
This is where you get a little bit of science. You know that if you were, say, a mouse, and you were living in an environment, happily, and then all of a sudden things turn cold, if you have short hair, you're going to shiver and then maybe die.
Right.
But if another mouse happens to have longer hair...
You know, they're going to do better. They're going to do better in life. They're going to have more baby mice.
So over time, in this community, you're going to get more and more and more mice with longer and longer hair.
Makes sense.
Now, these mice, they don't choose the length of their hair. They just have the hair they got. It is the weather. It is the local environment. That's what really shapes these mice. And you could think of the hat in the same way.
We're looking at the hat shape itself. The hat shape is changing over time without any forethought.
Thanks to that gold rush in the 1860s, you got a whole bunch of very different hats showing up on the Great Plains. And all those hats show up on heads, and those heads and hats are going to have horribly cold winters, searingly hot summers. They're going to be in the wind. They're going to be out of doors because the main occupation is going to be moving cattle across the plains.
Mm-hmm.
In this very competitive hat situation, the hat that's going to survive is the hat that keeps you comfortable, keeps you cool, keeps you dry. In other words, the cowboy hat. Therefore, in this third version of our story, according to Johnny...
The environment created the hat.
The wind created the hat. The rain. The sun. The snow. The weather created those hats.
Absolutely right.
This hat was just bound to appear in that place in that time.
It would have been invented by someone. The environment was right.
There's something kind of poetic about the idea that the hat was called the boss of the planes. And if your third movie is correct, then it's really the planes were the boss of the hat or something
yeah,
else.
That's true.
Chad, that's brilliant. I like that one.
But see, on the other hand, I'm not sure I like it because, like, I'm just thinking about all the edits that we do as storytellers. Like, for the pieces in the show, like, the thing we're always trying to do is kind of get to moments, and we're trying to always atomize everything, get down to the particular person who made the particular decision that resulted in the particular change. Like, that's what we want as storytellers. So in some sense, your scenario three is like the death of story, in some sense. It's the anti-story.
Feels less glamorous, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it runs
counter.
But you
know what? Do you know what? When Darwin came up with the theory of, well, when he published his theory of evolution by natural selection, that felt like a death in a way, because it felt like you were taking away the creator, this amazing being. You were diminishing life to a sort of mindless process. So a lot of people criticized him for the same thing. It's not as romantic. It's not as, well, it is as awesome. It's just not in the same way.
All right, well, we should go. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Jana Levin.
Hi, this is David Levitt.
This is James Glickin.
I'm calling to lead the credit.
Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes
Alan Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters,
Kim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Molly Webster,
Melissa O'Donnell, Jamie York, Dylan Keith, Lynn Levy,
and Andy Mills, with help from Ariane Wack and Damiano Marchetti.
Special thanks to Sean Cole. Yay, I got through it just as somebody walked in the door. Okay, let me know if I have to do it again. Bye.
End of message.